Welcome back to Alternative Realities. I'm David Kelly, Chief Global Strategist here at JP Morgan Asset Management. We first launched the Guide to Alternatives back in 2019 to provide an objective and research-based document for institutional and retail investors alike to make more informed investment decisions in the growing alternative space. The Guide to Alternatives has provided investors a one-stop shop for all things alternatives across multiple alternative asset classes. Joining me today to talk about the history of the Guide to Alternatives and also to share some of his high conviction investment ideas is David Leibovitz, Managing Director and Strategist at the Multi-Asset Solutions Group here at JP Morgan Asset Management. So David, welcome to Alternative Realities.
Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to our conversation today.
So David, you've been involved with the Guide to Alternatives since its inception. Can you talk a little bit about what drove the need for a Guide to Alternatives and what role it plays today for investors?
Absolutely. So, in 2018 and 2019, we were having a lot of conversations with our institutional clients, and we'd go in with our copies of the Guide to the Markets, and we'd talk about the macroeconomic outlook. We'd talk about the outlook for publicly traded stocks, publicly traded bonds, the importance of asset allocation and portfolio construction. But what I found was that there was a bit of a blind spot when it came to alternatives and private markets. And because that client base, you know, for the most part, invests so heavily in those types of assets, we really thought that it would be valuable to take the framework we had created in Guide to the Markets and port it over to the very opaque world of alternatives. And that was really the beginning of our foray into these asset classes. What's been interesting over the past couple of years is as we've seen alternative strategies and assets become increasingly accessible to a broader array of investors, the Guide to Alternatives has become even more important. You know, an asset class that was traditionally reserved for those institutional or high net worth investors is becoming more broadly accessible to the investment community. And you know, these are, as I mentioned, opaque assets. They can be difficult to understand. And there was really no top-down view of what was happening across private equity, private credit, real assets, so on and so forth. And so what really started as a way of better informing ourselves to have more insightful conversations with our clients has really evolved into a tool for the industry to unpack what's going on beneath the surface when it comes to these type of strategies.
Yeah, and one of the things I've liked since the beginning is that it puts a structure around the way we think about alternatives, because it can seem like not just opaque, as you pointed out, but really very daunting for investors to think about, well, all the possible alternatives. So once you bucket them into things like private equity, private credit, real estate, and you've got a systematic way of approaching the subject, it really makes it easier to pick one area of it, then go deep and really understand what's going on there. So I think that structure in terms of how we communicate, but also how we think about it has always been important and increasingly important now, of course, as you say, as we have a broadening out to more individual investors investing in alternatives. So that's kind of how we got started. But of course, you have now moved over to JP Morgan's multi-asset solutions team. I'm very sorry to lose you from Market Insights, but you're not very far away. But can you describe what your team does and what's your role in that team?
Absolutely. So the Multi-Asset Solutions Group at JP Morgan is responsible for all of our portfolios that are not specific to a single asset class. So it can be stocks and bonds, it can be stocks, bonds, and alternatives. And we manage money for institutions, endowments, foundations. We also have a number of retail products as well. One of the things that's happened over the course of time, particularly with respect to our institutional clients, is they've wanted more private market assets. They've wanted more alternatives in these portfolios. And so we've spent quite a bit of time and actually launched a dedicated research team to unpack what's going on in real estate, in private credit, in private equity, so on and so forth. The challenge is always how you fit the pieces together, right? You know, a lot of people are very comfortable putting stocks and bonds together, say 60% stocks, 40% bonds. How do you think about allocating to alternatives within the context of those public market assets? And that's where we really lean into this idea of taking an outcome-oriented approach. So for us, different alternatives can do very different types of things. We generally see them providing three things to investors. They can enhance the stream of income that's being delivered. They can provide additional diversification, or they can provide a more robust rate of return. And so when we start thinking about putting all of these pieces together, into a multi-asset solution for our clients, we're always thinking about the client objective. What is the client trying to achieve? Are they trying to match their liabilities with the income stream for their portfolio, or are they going to growth? And we really use that in conjunction with our long-term capital market assumptions as a bit of a North Star when it comes to putting together these more sophisticated multi-asset strategies.
And then again, with a focus, I guess, on what clients want alternatives to do for them. But how do you think about sort of sizing the allocation of alternatives within a portfolio?
So that's the challenging bit, because with publicly traded assets, they price every day, and you can use traditional mean variance optimization to come up with a recommended baseline allocation for a portfolio. The problem with alternatives and specifically private assets is that they mark to market quarterly, semi-annually, right? Much less frequently, and furthermore, with much lower volatility than what we see on the public side of the equation. And so if you were to feed those volatilities and those expected returns into a traditional optimizer, the optimizer would tell you to put everything in alts because you end up with a better risk-adjusted return. The way that we think about it is somewhere between 20 and 30% in alternatives is a good place to start, and that would be a diversified allocation to alternatives. And we've done a lot of work looking at if public markets completely fall apart, how did the allocation shift? How does the private market allocation grow in light of a decline in the allocation to the public markets? And if we can build expectations around how much that alternatives allocation will fluctuate against the backdrop of public market stress, we can begin to hone in more accurately on what the optimal allocation is for a given investor. So it's not necessarily as precise as what you would get using, marked assets that are marked to market every single day, but we are trying to take some science and apply it to something that has traditionally been much more art driven and not necessarily as quantitative.
And of course, in recent years, we've seen a lot more interest in alternatives. We've also seen the variety of different kinds of alternatives really blossom in the marketplace. And in particular, I'm thinking about liquid alternatives. So how do you, first of all, how would you define liquid alternatives broadly? And then what sort of role can they play in portfolios?
Sure. So I think it's best to think about this in terms of a spectrum. And on the one end, you have the truly liquid alternatives, which are going to be strategies that, for the most part, have a liquid underlying asset, whether that be equities or fixed income. And then portfolio managers will use various derivative overlays or various types of option-related strategies to manage the volatility and return of those funds. Then somewhere in the middle, you have these semi-liquid alternatives. Think about an evergreen private equity fund, an interval fund, things along those lines, where you don't necessarily have daily liquidity, but you have more frequent liquidity and more accessible liquidity than you would get in a traditional, say, closed-end vehicle, which is going to be on the very illiquid part of the spectrum. If you think about, a private equity fund, usually the life of those strategies is somewhere between 7 and 10 years. And you have to pay a penalty for the most part if you want to take your money out prematurely. Yes, the growth in the secondaries market has allowed for a bit better liquidity on that end of the spectrum. But we think about the continuation between those purely liquid vehicles and then those purely illiquid vehicles. And we try to manage that liquidity in conjunction with the overall goals of the portfolios. But what I would say about liquid alternatives specifically is I think that they're playing a key role in the current environment. What we learned in 2022 is that when inflation is what's bugging the market, stock bond correlations tend to be positive. That effectively means that you have one big bet on across your portfolio because you're not getting the diversification from things like duration that you would get in that negative stock bond correlation environment. And so when it particularly comes to diversification, I would also add when it comes to generating income, we think that liquid alternatives can be a great first step for investors into the world of alternative investments.
Well, as I said, there are a wide range of alternatives now available. What would you say is your highest conviction area within alternatives today?
So right now we are most excited about real estate, and that was something that came through in our long-term capital market assumptions with respect to the upgraded return estimate. But it also just has to do with really the starting valuation. And when we look at what's going on in the world today, assets like office, things like certain retail properties, they frankly look fairly attractive from a valuation perspective. And we believe that the path of least resistance is for improvement particularly in office. On the other hand, you look at things like industrial, which were obviously the belle of the ball during the pandemic when everybody thought that they were never going to take off their sweatpants and have everything delivered to their front door. We're fading that part of the real estate market in the current environment, really trying to lean into where we're seeing those more attractive valuations. And the key thing here, and I think this is not necessarily front of mind for a lot of investors, we're not looking for valuations to rise all that much. We don't need cap rate compression, which the cap rate is the way that you measure real estate valuations. It's basically the income divided by the net asset value of the property. We don't need valuation expansion. We don't need cap rate compression in order to hit our expected return targets. Frankly, a macroeconomic backdrop characterized by real growth around 2% and inflation somewhere between 2 and 2.5% is going to allow for income growth from these properties that, in our view, will generate a fairly robust return. And while we're making slow but steady progress on inflation, I would remind everybody who's listening that inflation actually isn't the worst thing in the world when it comes to assets like real estate. And so we get that uncorrelated stream of income, we get that inflation protection, and we're getting it at a price that we're finding attractive in a world where both stocks and bonds are looking somewhat expensive.
All right, so if real estate opportunities get the gold medal, how about the silver and the bronze? What else do you think is attractive right now?
So the two other key areas of focus for us are private equity and private credit. Starting with private equity, we think that after a couple of tough years in terms of the IPO environment, the exit environment, things there are beginning to turn. You're seeing more assets begin to trade. You're seeing fundraising continue at a relatively healthy clip. I actually ran an update of some of the numbers from the Guide to Alts on the fundraising numbers so far in 2025. And although they've started a little bit soft, about half of the fundraising we've seen has gone into private equity. And when we look at where public equity valuations are today, we recognize the hurdle for further valuation expansion is likely quite high. I mean, 20% plus back-to-back years in the S&P 500 is pretty good, especially when it comes with below average volatility. And so we still want to maintain this pro-risk view in portfolios. We still want to reach and try to generate that outsized return. And we think that private equity is increasingly becoming an attractive way of achieving that outcome. I would also add that if you look at a sector breakdown of the private equity market, about 40% of it is concentrated in technology. And while some of the mega cap technology companies in the S&P 500 are undoubtedly looking expensive, and certainly very robust growth expectations have been increasingly priced in, we think that private equity, again, is potentially a better way of accessing those same long-term structural themes that we identified in the LTCMAs. At the same time, we see an opportunity in private credit, but I would give private credit and specifically direct lending the bronze medal. We think that the uncorrelated income streams that private credit and direct lending can provide are certainly attractive. We also think when you look beyond direct lending at things like distressed investments or capital solutions or special situations, those are going to be important and should see fairly attractive returns going forward, particularly as we sort things out in parts of the commercial real estate market where direct lending has stepped in as a provider of funds, but we don't live under a rock. We've seen the growth in the number of assets invested in private credit. We've seen the growth in the number of managers in the private credit universe. And when you have growth on the scale that we've seen over the past few years, there are undoubtedly going to be some bad apples amongst the bunch. And so we think that when it comes to direct lending and private credit, this is an allocation that has gone from optional to essential. And on the institutional side, I would argue it's become a dedicated allocation, particularly for some of our larger clients. But as is true across the alternative spectrum, manager selection is increasingly important because, by our lights, private credit hasn't really been through a true default cycle. Part of the benefit to private credit is you have bespoke loans that are underwritten to a specific borrower. And so you have that element of flexibility that can prevent a traditional default, but trees don't grow to the sky. And I do think here, in an environment where rates are higher for longer, we could well begin to see some signs of stress materialize in that space over the course of the next 12 months.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about that because, obviously we've seen tremendous growth in private credit. It's but enough cash will ruin any asset class. So you have to be more careful in terms of how you invest in private credit. How do you sort of see this evolving? Where is there any particular strategy that you'd advise in terms of investing in private credit right now?
So there are a couple of things that we're keeping our eye on in private credit. I would say first and foremost, we recognize the relationship that has evolved and emerged between private equity and private credit. And a lot of the financing for private equity deals is increasingly being done through the private credit channel. To us, that can be a little bit of right pocket, left pocket. And we just are cautious when we begin to see those synergies really come front and center with certain managers. We're also looking for clarity on how the loans are underwritten. You know, part of the nature of private markets is they're opaque and they can be difficult to understand. We want to focus on managers that have a proven track record and a proven process and aren't just going out there and lending to a borrower at, you know, the overnight rate plus a spread that they think their clients will find attractive. We want to find managers who are focused on making the right loans to the right types of companies, and to us that's most attractive. I would also go back to something I said during our prior question, which was about the growing nature of the private credit market. You have things like real estate debt, venture debt, special sits, capital solutions. To us, really, the key to successful investing in private credit going forward is going to be understanding the risks that exist in the direct lending space, which is for a lot of people their first step into private credit, but also embracing the broader opportunity set, which we think could benefit from the macroeconomic environment as it evolves here on a go-forward basis.
And, you know, I know you and I, we chat a lot about sort of the short-term outlook, and in your current seat, you have to focus to some extent on, you know, what's going to do well in the next year or two. But alternatives are inherently a long-term asset. So how do you kind of square that circle? How are you able to sort of have that long-term view of alternatives and but still make it useful when making, you know, shorter-term portfolio decisions?
So it's a bit of a balancing act, and I actually think it melds together a lot of the things that we've been talking about over the course of our time together today. On the one hand, you need to be aware of what's happening in a market at any given point in time. And so if we use real estate as an example, again, valuations are attractive, fundamentals are supportive, and technicals are improving. We're seeing issuance pick up, we're seeing transaction volumes pick up. And so for us, and this is particularly relevant given the temperature outside these days in New England, it feels like we're finally having a bit of a thaw. And so we want to take advantage of that as it's materializing while simultaneously understanding and building discrete expectations about what that asset class can provide over time. And so the way that I would think about it is the long-term view really ties back to that outcome-oriented approach. What are you trying to achieve by investing in the asset? And then the way that the macroeconomic and the market environment is fluctuating on a day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month basis really can help inform you as to when you want to pull the trigger. And you need to be cognizant of cues and the amount of time it's going to take to get invested, but it really amalgamates everything that we've been discussing here today. That short-term view informs when you pull the trigger. That long-term view informs the way you build expectations around the investment that you're making.
So I guess to paraphrase what you're saying, the you know the it's a long t these are long-term assets, and the fundamentals are long-term, but pricing is always short-term because the prices just move up and down, and you've got to be aware of that in order to make the best of the long-term opportunity.
Exactly, and you're seeing it in real estate today. You know, again, you look at some of the properties that are beginning to trade, you're very much seeing that market thaw, and we want to be on the front foot and take advantage of those attractive valuations while they're present before everybody else jumps on the proverbial train.
Very interesting. Listen, first of all, David, thank you very much for all your work over the years on building this guide to alternatives, which you think is an amazing product and really a great complement now to our Alternative Realities podcast. And thank you for joining us here on Alternative Realities.
Absolutely. Looking forward to coming back soon.
This material is for information purposes only. The views, opinions, and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions are those of the speaker and may differ from those expressed by J.P. Morgan Asset Management or by other areas of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company. Any companies referenced are shown for illustrative purposes only and are not intended as a recommendation. We believe the information provided here is reliable but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors. This content is intended for information only based on assumptions and current market conditions and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. J.P. Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.